Hey there, veterans. This is Justin with a quick note before today's show. I've put together a few free ebooks that serve as a quantitative complement to these qualitative interviews. So if that's how your brain works, head over to the resources tab at beyonduniform.io and check them out. Hope that helps and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 50. Can you believe it? We're at 50 episodes. And today's interview is with Eileen Teague.
And I know that sounds really broad, but that's what people that are working in academia are doing. It's knowledge production, right? And so knowledge production is not just sitting around, you know, reading on a beach chair and saying, oh, I love foreign policy. I mean, it's actually, you know, reading some of the dry stuff. It's engaging with others. It's writing, it's thinking, and it's seeing how you're going to kind of, whether or not you agree with ways that we see things now, and if you don't agree with them, do you know ways based on what you read and your conversations with people, how can we change the way that we look at things?
The top two reasons to listen to today's episode are, number one, academia. Eileen is a rock star. She's a Fulbright scholar and now a PhD candidate, which is the academic equivalent of the Olympics. She talks about her path to get here, why she loves it, and advice for other veterans looking to do the same. I'm sure someday soon she'll be a talking head on CNN, but remember you heard her on Beyond the Uniform first. Number two, side jobs. The PhD path is not initially lucrative, and Eileen has become adept at making it work to get there. She talks about her work with sprinklers, Uber driving, the reserves, and other ways she's explored to give herself time to find out what she wants to do with her life. Number three, ambiguity. Eileen's story is a case study in handling ambiguity. Whether it was making her way in foreign countries or structuring her life each day as a PhD student, she's found a way to thrive with ambiguity. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other great episodes and resources. One episode in particular I'd recommend is episode number 27 with Katie Horgan. Katie and Eileen served together at OCS and TBS, and it's interesting to compare their very different paths since then. You'll also find the show notes for this episode, which provides links to the websites we discuss on the show, as well as timestamps for each topic we cover. So let's dive in to my interview with Eileen Teague. Well, joining me from Nashville, Tennessee, my guest today is Eileen Teague. Eileen, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hi, happy to be here.
So for our listeners, I wanted to give them a quick background. Eileen is a PhD candidate at Vanderbilt University, where she studies U.S. and Latin American history. She'll finish her doctoral studies next summer and move towards her ambition of being a history professor. She teaches history at both Vanderbilt University and Nashville State Community College and serves as an assistant coach on the marksmanship team of the Nashville All-Boys School Montgomery Bell Academy. She started out at Boston University studying history and participating in the NROTC program. Afterwards, she served 4 years active duty and 4 years as a reservist as an officer in the Marine Corps. After the Marine Corps, she earned her Master's of Arts in History at Vanderbilt and also was the recipient of a Fulbright scholarship that took her to Mexico City to conduct research on Mexico's experience with U.S. war on drugs over the course of 10 months. Since returning from Mexico, Eileen has published various opinion pieces on her research and continues to write her dissertation, which focuses on the effects of U.S. drug control policies in 1970s Mexico. So, Eileen, I guess just anything to add or amend on that intro?
I think that you did a great job there, Justin. That about covers it. I'm finishing up. I'm an academic, an aspiring academic, a student in a sense, always a student. And I study kind of like the origins of drug cartels in Mexico.
That's awesome. Well, maybe we'll start there of just, especially for someone who's on active duty, how would you explain your life as a PhD candidate?
You know, I was, I saw some of the questions and I was looking at this one, and this one was the one that kind of made me giggle the most, because it's, in many ways, it's the complete opposite of my life, when I was in the military. It's a lot of unstructured time, and a lot of big goals, to complete, which sometimes you don't really see the fruits of the day-to-day basis. It's just studying various aspects of this large subject, a lot of reading, a lot of writing. And so, yeah, I'm looking at a lot of my data now that I collected when I was in Mexico. And so that kind of comprises the first part of my day. And then the other parts of my day, I teach history. Usually I teach in the afternoons. Part of my day is kind of looking at my research, and writing, and going with that. And the other aspect is, engaging with people, which is, the most important part. The research for me is, and the writing, and things like that. And what I study, is a way to, converse and connect with others. So that's why, teaching is my passion, and those two kind of, feed off of each other.
How do you, I'm just curious, having so much, it's funny because what you're saying mirrors what a lot of entrepreneurs I talk to say, which is there's so much unstructured time. There's just so much, so much to do and no clear guidance on the way in which to do it. And I'm just wondering, how do you approach that? Does your studies just pervade every aspect and every hour of your day or weekend and all of that? Or how do you put boundaries around that?
That's such a great question, and that's something I think about a lot. I wake up every morning, and not that you wanted to hear too much practical advice, but the military still very much lives, the structure of the military still very much lives into how I approach my daily tasks in terms of list making and setting kind of short-term, mid-term, and long-range goals. Sometimes I'm in the classroom, sometimes I'm, working at school at Vanderbilt. You kind of just kind of keep moving around. Sometimes I work from home, and sometimes you can only work from home for so long. I'm always trying to make goals, and then also, keep it for the most part, within the realm of a work day. After 6 o'clock, my brain shuts off, and I think progressively I still wake up pretty early. I'm up at 5:30 to get a lot of this stuff done and to set my goals for the day. But my brain progressively starts to shut off at about 1 or 2 p.m. And so the rest of the day is just kind of seeing what else I can get done. And then at 1700, 1800 for the late, that is sort of the end of my day, and I have to find ways to kind of put aside some of the dissertation research and some of the stuff from the classroom.
And the PhD process, how long does that typically take, or how long will that end up taking for you, you think, when you're all in and all done?
It's going to be about 6 or 7 years just in grad school. It varies. It depends on when exactly it is that I will submit my dissertation for completion. It's about 6 or 7 years. Since starting. So it's a long time in school. And then if you kind of add up the time for undergrad, that's over a decade in college, which looking back kind of makes me giggle. And then makes me cry.
I have always thought of Olympic athletes and PhD recipients or candidates as the antithesis of my background as an MBA, which is kind of jack of all trades, master of none. And instead, you've chosen to take a deep dive in a subject where ostensibly you'll be one of the most knowledgeable people in the world when you're done with your dissertation. And that's, I think that's just really remarkable. And just to clarify, so your specific thesis is around how the U.S. drug control policies affected Mexico in the 70s. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah. A lot of us might watch Narcos, or there's a lot of shows about drug cartels and movies that we see in pop culture and the media. Right now, drug cartels are kind of in. The drug cartels are in, and you have El Chapo, who's kind of a very mysterious figure to many people. A lot of these questions and themes that we're talking about with respect to the drug trade and drug cartels, they really originate to this period that I'm studying in the late 1960s and 1970s. That is the kind of the thrust of my the argument that I'm making in my dissertation. You have to look at how in this period I'm looking at, you kind of have to look at certain dynamics in Mexican social and political institutions and how they really interact with the U.S. war on drugs that's really kind of making its push overseas after 1971. And I'm looking at how the United States is sending, quote unquote, advisors to supervise drug enforcement efforts from Mexican government figures, from the military, intelligence organizations. Mexican intelligence organizations is what I mean, and how basically this war on drugs, the U.S. war on drugs, is exported and received in Mexican society. And what that really does, given Mexico's very own and unique history and background. I mean, and this is kind of a template for many people that have deployed to many parts of the world. I mean, this whole question of how U.S. policies affect local cultures, I mean, it's a question that we're asking not only in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, but in the Middle East, in Asia, in other parts of the third world. And so that is, I mean, this kind of question of U.S. involvement and the unintended consequences that it has is kind of one of the basic questions that I'm asking and studying in my dissertation.
Well, my curiosity is getting the better of me. I wanted to ask you a bunch of questions about the PhD process and where you go from here, and we'll come back to that. But I'm just dying to know, let's reverse time and when you were in the Marines. Before we even get there, like, when did you know you wanted to pursue a PhD? Was this something from childhood, or when was the genesis of this thought of, like, I want to get my doctorate?
That's a good question. I mean, it happened very, very quickly. A good friend of mine, it was Thanksgiving of 2009, and I was figuring out what I was going to do when I got out of the Marine Corps, when I served my 4 years. And I was supposed to get out in the summer of 2010 to finish my active duty time. And I was exploring a host of options from law school. And I knew I wanted to work in something having to do with international relations and foreign policy, which, I mean, you talk to a lot of people coming out of the Marines, and many times the military whets their appetite to know more about other cultures and foreign relations. And I was kind of no different in that sense. But I've always had a passion for history and for teaching. And I kind of knew in the back of my head that I always wanted to be a college professor. I mean, because college was a very formative time for me. And I had great relationships with my professors. And I kind of, it was just a time when things kind of just took off for me, both personally and academically. And so I kind of wanted to be that mentor figure for someone like me one day in a university. And so that's kind of the teaching, where the passion for teaching arises from. But I mean, the truth is, to get into those kinds of positions, you also have to be you have to read and write a lot and do a lot of research and studying on your own before you can even think about applying to those kinds of positions. And so I didn't realize that I could, you know, I would be able to, or kind of could find a path to do that, until a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, just kind of brought up out of the picture, why don't you just apply for the PhDs and see what happened? And I was I sat on that question for a while throughout early 2010 then, and I got out in the summer of 2010. And I mean, this will probably come up in some other things that we talk about, but a lot of people, a lot of my peers in the Marines, there's a lot of stress to have your plan, to have a very clear-cut plan for what's going to happen when you get out. I mean, the expectation is that you have to seamlessly roll into, you know, a perfect job. And many people end up going to very good jobs, working as defense contractors, for example, or doing something that's very related to their command where they got out of. And I basically knew I wanted to get a PhD, but I didn't know how exactly I was going to do it. And so I got out and I kind of gave myself some time to travel around and then go and ask questions and kind of learn. I kind of gave myself a 6-month period to go around and make myself look like I had been studying a lot of these things, and I was prepared to be conversant with others in the academy and academia that explore some of these academic questions that I wanted to explore. And you know, and then from there, I just started putting together applications. And so it was a very indirect course. I mean, some of my peers here at Vanderbilt and others that I've met, I mean, they've been preparing for their PhD and their research, I mean, since their undergraduate studies. And for me, I did undergrad, I got that done. I went in the Marines, I had some wonderful experiences, made some great friends. And then I was like, okay, I need to sound like I could be in a PhD program and am on track to be a college professor someday. And so that was basically what I did in that year between getting out of the Marines and starting grad school.
And if you don't mind me asking, so there's a couple questions that came up when you were saying that. So first of all, I love this thought of giving yourself 6 months after separation to figure out what you want and just get a little bit of breathing room. For someone who's aspiring to do that as well, how much money, I know this obviously varies by person and how you're using it, but what's your sense of like how much money they should be saving up or setting aside to be able to give themselves that 6 months of room to travel or explore or just really figure out what they want to do?
That's such a great question. And I mean, I always have a hard time answering these like, you know, black and white 100% answer type questions. I was really lucky. I was in Boston for 3 months, reconnecting with old professors. And so a friend of mine let me sleep on her couch and she worked crazy hours. So I, you know, cleaned her house for her. And I had some help from my, at some points during that time I stayed with family and I kind of got a side job too for a little while there working at a sprinkler repair company. You know, I'm the kind of person that's about getting your hands dirty and working, you know, if you're able. And so I was doing kind of a lot of mindless work during that period as well. But I say it's probably good to have, you know, at least, I mean, you know, anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 at least, depending on how you use your resources. And if you kind of get a side job, I mean, these days you can do all kinds of side jobs to kind of sustain yourself that don't require, that kind of get yourself away from the that environment of the military or other kinds of stressful environments and give you some freedom to make some money while at the same time you are kind of getting some time to think seriously about what you want to do with your life and how you're going to be able to do it.
Any sites or side jobs in particular come up as you think of that, of just kind of a little bit of an oasis of a way to generate income while figuring out what to do?
Well, I've met a couple of veteran Uber drivers recently, and not that I want to say I'm putting my hand down of being like the advocate for going to get a job for Uber. I mean, but there's so many little jobs like that. I mean, I happen to work for a little while on the side with a small sprinkler repair company in Texas where my family lived, owned by a family that my family knew. And so that was just kind of one thing, kind of keeping the options open. And I mean, this was by no means anything I was going to do for forever, but it was just a way to kind of, you know, make some money and sustain myself while I was, you know, doing some of these things and preparing to start grad school. And then also too, after I kind of felt like I had that distance, it was about 10 months after I got out, maybe a little less, 9 or 10 months, I went and started doing reserve work. And that was a way to also start to put some money aside as well. And so the reserves, it was completely, I did 4 years active. I got out in June of 2010. And then I started doing reservist work in April of 2011. So there was a period there where I wasn't connected to the Marines and could kind of, you know, figure out what I wanted to do next. But then the great thing about the reserves is that there's a lot of flexibility and people want to work with your schedule in many cases. I mean, sometimes you can switch what you do if you kind of want something a little bit more exciting or something more flexible. And a lot of times you can make it work around your schedule. And there's a lot of different, at least with the Marines, there were a lot of different reserve options. And for 4 years, they worked with my graduate school schedule, the command I was attached with. But after the fourth year, it just ended up being to the fact that I was going to Mexico and that wasn't necessarily that great. My command didn't love that. I just didn't have a lot of time. And the time I did have, I wanted to be in Nashville or I wanted to be traveling and seeing friends. And so it was just a natural progression that it's not that I wanted to not do reserves anymore. It's just that there were other things that there were many things competing for my time at that period.
That's great. I mean, I love the example of hustle of, sleep on a friend's couch and working at a sprinkler repair and just kind of doing whatever it takes to give yourself room. And I also love that thought. It's such a positive endorsement for the reserves. And I hadn't thought of that as such an accessible source of supplemental income for people. And I like that thought of how flexible it is that you can work it around your schedule as you're pursuing other things.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, I'll add that I was very lucky. I mean, I have my own specific situation. I was at that point, I'm single or I didn't have any kids. And so I was lucky in the fact that I didn't have, a family to necessarily support, I didn't have any kind of debt from undergrad or anything like that. Other people are not in that situation and have other factors that they have to weigh into consideration. But for getting out, I was lucky enough to be debt-free and have some money put away so that I could kind of have this time. Because for me, I had gone into ROTC not really knowing what I had gotten myself into. My dad had been a retired Navy senior chief, a CV. And so I just wanted to find the best way to be self-sufficient. So I did ROTC, which was a wonderful experience. And then I did my time in the Marines, but then I kind of wanted to have my time to figure out what my own path was going to be. And so that the reserves and other, side things and just saving money while I was in the Marines kind of helped that process.
That's great. And you mentioned the application process. Could you step a veteran through what did that look like for you in terms of applying to be a PhD candidate?
Well, you have to kind of get back. I went back to Boston where I went to where I did my undergrad and rekindled with some professors that I had been close with as an undergrad. And I mean, you have to. All kinds of all graduate programs are different. They ask for different things. Most of them ask for some sort of personal statement, particularly in academic type programs where you're applying to be a researcher. You have to kind of show that you have some kind of personal or academic experience that that supports why you want to research a certain topic. And that shows that you've really thought through and connected with people and connected with the literature out there on what it is that you want to study. So you have to show that basically you're not like I really was and woke up one morning and said, like, I want to be in a PhD program. You have to kind of show that you've thought it through and that you actually know what you're getting yourself into. And so that was a lot of what I did in the 6 months between finishing the Marines or in the 6 to 9 months between finishing the Marines and kind of getting those applications in. But for me, I mean, I guess practically speaking, you have to submit a personal statement, usually some sort of research statement, what it is that you're going to be writing and researching once you get into graduate school. I mean, what in your background helps you is going to help you in your research to ask interesting questions about a particular subject. And then there's other more practical things like gathering transcripts, getting recommendations. And even to really be proactive, I mean, Marines have a lot of really awesome life experiences, more so sometimes than people that just go right from undergrad to a master's to grad school. And so it really helps then to kind of, if you can and get on the train or get in your car or, get on a plane in some cases, or get on the phone, and start to connect with some of these people that you want to be linked to. It's kind of like networking on steroids in a sense. And we all like know what networking is. But when you're applying for some of these programs, it really helps if people have seen your face and that they've talked to you before. And for me, it was like kind of a nerve-wracking experience because I was just kind of giving myself a crash course in what I needed to sound competitive for these applications. But I was going and emailing people and linking up with people whose books I read and starting to ask them questions and starting to connect them. And if it seemed to be a good fit, seeing if they could be a dissertation advisor, which was sort of like the mentor that will take you through the program, will be the person that's critiquing your work the most, writing your recommendations and helping you as kind of like your it's a mentor-mentee type relationship as you're going through your graduate studies.
And it sounds like your kind of ambition from the start was to be a college professor. Is that hold true still? Do you think that after this you'll go on into full-time academia?
I hope so. I do. I mean, it's been a long road, and I haven't even really gotten into it yet. It's been a long road. I've learned so much about not only my research, but myself during this period. And that's still absolutely the goal. After I came back from doing my research in Mexico, I started to get really interested in writing, kind of putting my ideas more in simple journalism and op-ed pieces to connect with people. And I would like to teach at the college level, but eventually I would like to be in the position where I can work with government organizations that are creating or doing research for drug policy development. and be able to either sit on panels or help advise and that kind of thing. I mean, because I had taught a course last summer on the global war on drugs, which I loved, and I was able to bring in a lot of my a lot of insights and a lot of my materials from Mexico. And the thought of being able to kind of articulate what I research to students that are interested in a topic like drug policy creation, history, and how it informs our current drug debates. I mean, that is ideally what I want to be doing. I mean, finding ways to be engaged in the policy creation aspect. I mean, I focus on more contemporary history. I'm not studying like pirates or, you know, people in wagons in the 1800s. I mean, what I study has happened for the most part in our lifetime. Or maybe just a little bit before we were born. And so a lot of this history informs many of these policy debates that we're seeing on CNN. And so I want to be able to kind of, in my teaching, obviously have a heavy foundation in history and be a history professor, but also be able to be in a position where I can talk with people that are making and hopefully help inform current policy making.
And you know, going along with that, you've kind of touched on this, but what are, kind of broadly speaking, the career paths that you see people pursue post-PhD? It sounds like one track would be academia, one might be in public policy. Are there like, you know, 3 to 5 different typical career paths that you would say there are?
Absolutely. And I mean, I hesitate, Justin, there are many paths that people can take in academia. I mean, if you focus more on the sciences, for example, and biology or chemistry or something like that, perhaps, I mean, you could go into academia, but you could also work for a pharmaceutical company like Bayer or something like that. I mean, for people that have some sort of higher degree in engineering, I mean, there are certain kinds of options for both working in academia and then working in the private sector. For people who are studying the languages, I mean, there are opportunities to work as a translator or something like that on a higher scale, or do some very intense translating for some sort of organization. I happen to study contemporary history, and I mean, academia is an option. And even with academia, there's kind of this split for whether or not you go to what they call an R1 research university. Where your focus is more of like publishing, but also teaching, or you go to a liberal arts college. So where I went to undergrad, Boston University would be an R1 research institution, whereas somewhere like you went, the Naval Academy is actually considered a liberal arts college. And that's along the lines of something like Smith College, Wesleyan University, Williams College. I mean, these smaller liberal arts colleges. And so, I mean, there's also a split within where I would go in academia. And then also, because I study contemporary history, I could look into non-academic type jobs. I mean, some people get into historical consulting. It's not huge right now, but it's a growing field. And sometimes people that are exploring, people like law firms will hire historical consultants to go back and look. For example, my grandpa, he had mesothelioma a couple of years back. And so he was working with a firm that then had to dig up information then on asbestos use in the 1970s. And so something like that, you might assign to a historical consultant who could go out and look at records from that period. That's just one very specific example. Let's see. So historical consulting, I mean, working for something like the State Department. The State Department has a historian's office. But there are also other branches of government that you could probably apply to. Foreign Service Officer track, which is another thing that you don't have to have a PhD for. But some people from the military are interested in taking the Foreign Service Officer exam, which you could take and be a diplomat in essence. And so that is another option. I mean, there are many options out there. I mean, but the kind of the standard option is academia. The reality of it, though, is that sometimes the academic jobs are tend to be very competitive. And so, you know, and so you have to kind of navigate when it is that or how it is that you're going to get that kind of job and what your path is going to be. And if that's really going to fit in with what your, you know, personal life is looking like, if you're able to kind of do that.
And if a veteran's listening to this, and what you're saying sounds really exciting, what are some indications that they might be well suited to this potential career path and might really enjoy it? And what are some indications that this might be something that just drives them crazy or is not well suited for them?
That's a great question. I think that you kind of have to be patient and you kind of have to have a passion for the material. And I know that sounds really broad and sort of cliche, but if you are, good as an independent operator and self-motivator, and you're interested in kind of picking at a topic for a while and being an expert in it and being able to communicate ideas to others, then perhaps this is something that might interest you. In terms of being, well suited, I don't think I even really knew what I needed. I don't think I really even knew what I was necessarily, going to be doing on a day-to-day basis when I was in the application stage. I just think that if you, have the commitment to want to study some of these issues, and kind of want to play the marathon game, with some of these, realizing that you're not going to go and get a crash course, on some of these issues, you're actually dedicating yourself to knowing them. And so I've talked to a lot of my friends, veterans and not non-veterans, and they talk about, oh, wow, what you do is so great because you get to, I just want to sit around and read, all the time, and get to know these kinds of issues. And yeah, that's, that's all well and good, but sometimes you're going to read things that you aren't necessarily going to love to read. And it comes down to whether or not you kind of have the if you want to push yourself to kind of engage some of this challenging material in these subjects, and whether or not you kind of just want this overview deal, like kind of the Economist or the magazine type summary of some of these issues, or whether or not you really kind of want to discover what makes, why knowledge is created in a certain sense or in a certain way and who creates it, and what you can do to kind of influence how our knowledge is created and perhaps how we can change how we conceive things. And I know that sounds really broad, but that's what people that are working in academia are doing. It's knowledge production, right? And so knowledge production is not just sitting around, reading on a beach chair and saying, oh, I love foreign policy. It's actually, reading some of the dry stuff. It's reading, it's engaging with others, it's writing, it's thinking, and it's seeing how you're going to kind of, whether or not you agree with ways that we see things now. And if you don't agree with them, do you know ways, based on what you read and your conversations with people, how can we change the way that we look at things?
What do you like least about, what is the hardest part for you of doing this marathon academic pursuit?
I think that the hardest thing I have to say is it's a lot of in your head time, right? And so I used to be someone who, a lot of times when you work in the military, you kind of take for granted this like automatic network you have around you, this social network, of people that you come in, even if you just like come in like morning gunnery sergeant, morning sergeant, how's it going? And you're constantly interacting with people. And here, I am interacting with people for me. Some people are okay kind of being, an island, in my, that are in my field and internal. And for me, I think that the hardest part is, a lot of the individual time, a lot of the quiet time, a lot of the in your head time. Because that I didn't realize before. I thought that I was someone who was okay not really talking to anyone. But once you're in this stage, sometimes when you're, hours writing or hours you're researching and you're not really interacting with someone regularly, sometimes that starts to weigh on you, and I realize that I am a very social person that likes to interact with people. And so, I frame a lot of my work then on, how best it's going to lead me towards, panels and conferences, and engagements with students and classes, to make it, full circle of a conversation and interaction, with individuals, motivated individuals that want to learn, and, want to learn from each other.
That's great. I think going into this, my preconception was that what you do is the antithesis of what my military experience, and I think a lot of people's is, which is a lot of execution and operations and doing and getting shit done. And some things as you're talking that kind of jump out to me is that there's a lot of parallels of what you're doing in the military as well. And I look back to when I decided to go to the Naval Academy, and then, you know, you're signing up for, in my case, 9 years, right? 4 years of the Academy, 5 years of service, which was a big commitment at the time. And similarly for your PhD process, you're committing to just such a chunk of time, as you've said, before you even really know what it's like. And you're kind of going down this path with an early on decision. And I also think of the military, that just how much discipline it builds in you, and that regiment and that kind of structure. And it's encouraging to hear how you've applied that to the PhD process and how that's helping you succeed, of being able to create structure out of nothing and have that discipline and that ability to just stick with material that's not appealing and just kind of push through even when it's not appealing to you. So that's, it's just been interesting to hear your experience, because it's different than I would have expected.
It's an interesting experience, we'll say that.
And I wanted to dive into the Fulbright scholarship as well, but maybe before we move on to that, anything we didn't cover about the PhD process, of advice for veterans, or anything else you'd want listeners to know about that?
I would just say, I mean, I kind of, there, the way I've spoken about it, I mean, maybe I've highlighted some pros and cons, but I mean, I will say that every year it gets better. And it was never, you know, I've always liked what I've done. But every year, as you learn more, it gets better. You meet new people. You have more positive interactions with students. I mean, so if this is something that anyone is sort of interested in doing, and kind of being able to have that experience of teaching and mentoring in a sense, but then also being this, you know, figure on knowledge for someone, I mean, I would definitely encourage you to talk to people. I mean, email people that do what you want to do, and kind of go with that. I mean, it's a wonderful experience that when you wake up and you are actually doing the kinds of things that you enjoy doing, and reading the kinds of things that you, for the most part, enjoy reading about and talking about, and where there's this, where you see kind of this passion developing for your work, where it's to the point where it's not so much work. It's something that you, you know, it's a bigger process of something that you just love to do.
That's awesome. And so let's rewind the clock. At what point did you know you were going to leave the Marine Corps, and how did you approach that decision?
I basically knew I was going to do 4 years and then probably explore other options. I mean, because like you were just saying right now, I went into ROTC and then I went into the Marines, and I was always very excited. I had a really positive experience in the Marines, but I was always really excited to see, you know, to see what I would be like outside of the military. I mean, I grew up, my dad was in the Navy, then I was in the ROTC program and the military. And so I was very excited to see what else, what other options I had out there. And so I basically knew I was going to get out at 4 years pretty early on. Pretty early on. But I mean, as you can see, I came back very quickly as a reservist, and that worked out well for me for a couple years. And both, you know, both experiences as active duty and reservist, I mean, had many merits. And so I got out, I kind of found my track, and then I came back for as long as I could.
That's awesome. And so talk about the Fulbright scholarship. Like, for someone who's not familiar with that program, and I mean, it's extremely prestigious, it's extremely selective. How would you explain that program, and how did you find your way there?
Well, Fulbright is it's kind of like the flagship cultural exchange program for the U.S. I mean, it was developed in, I believe, in the 60s or 70s, and it supports researchers, teachers of English to many countries abroad to kind of enhance U.S. Relations with other countries and so on and so forth. And so I applied to a specific researcher program that was funding. So, I mean, when someone studies history, the way that you get, when someone is getting, being a researcher in history, the way that you get your data is that you're working in documents, and you're writing stories off of documents, that you are able to, you know, that you see, and you actually go and look at the actual documents. And so in Mexico, I wanted to go in order to be able to write this story about how the U.S., drug policies affect Mexican social and political institutions. I had to go to Mexico and look at Mexican government documents, intelligence documents, talk to Mexican professors, and academics to kind of figure out what the story is looking like from the other side. And so essentially trying to write this U.S. story from Mexico. And so I went to Mexico in 2013 for the first time for 2 or 3 months to kind of see what my prospects were, to meet some people. I was in a program down in the south part of Mexico in a state called Oaxaca. And then I worked the rest of the time in Mexico City, where a lot of the Mexican archives are. And so I went there to kind of figure out what it was that I would be working in if I were there for a long period of time. And then I kind of went back to the U.S. In the fall of 2013 and took that data to roll into my applications. And so the Fulbright process is really lengthy for Mexico and a few other countries. It's even more lengthy, I believe, because you go through this process of submitting essays and submitting documentation on what your project is and what you'd be doing for 10 months. And then you have to be interviewed by people you have to make sure that you pass a language qualification by someone in the Spanish and Portuguese department. You have to make sure that you get interviewed by a panel of professors, and then they rank you and evaluate you. And then, so there was this office at most universities, major universities have an office where they kind of consolidate a lot of the Fulbright applications. And that kind of helps your cause if you're doing it through a university by doing it independently. And so in September of that year, all that stuff was due and I was interviewed. And then basically I hit the send button in early October 2013, and then I just kind of waited. Right. And then I was coming back in from the holidays in January of 2014. And then I realized at that point I had made it to the next stage. And so this is only my second Skype interview I've ever done. My first Skype interview was done by about 8 people inside the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City that were part of the Fulbright Commission in Mexico. And so the next part there is that I was in a Skype interview. We could actually see each other. And they were passing the computer around, and it was an interview in Spanish for about 25 minutes about my project. So they kind of make sure that you're, you know, legitimate, can speak the language, and that you actually have an agenda, and just kind of do a face-to-face. And then the final part of it was, not really, that was the second stage. And then I found out that I I was awarded the Fulbright in early April of 2014. And then I moved to Mexico that August of 2014. And that's when my 10 months started.
That's awesome. I'm reveling in the fact that I'm your second Skype interview, because I will say that I knew you when you're that talking head on CNN, when you're at the White House giving these briefings. I'll say, okay, she cut her teeth on Beyond the Uniform. This was the training ground.
I love that expression.
It's just, I've interacted at Stanford Business School and throughout my career with a couple of Fulbright scholars, and it just seems like such an incredible program, and the very intimate relationship you get to have with your country and being able to see it from so many different facets that, you know, I feel like most places I've traveled, I've just seen as a tourist. And there were a few times in business school in Ghana and Burkina Faso where we went and met with business leaders and political leaders. And it was just such an incredibly different perspective and vantage point. And that was just like for a week. And so I can't even imagine your degree of immersion and your depth of penetration to meet with different people and just see a country inside and out. I think that's really fantastic. And I can imagine, given the path you're on now, how that's really accelerated you in that path of expertise and mastering a subject and region.
It was a wonderful experience. And for the good and the bad, the Fulbright program, especially the Fulbright researcher program, it's no study abroad program. I studied abroad in Europe as an undergrad, and that was a lot of fun, and there was organized mixers, and there was very little, everything was kind of established for you. With the Fulbright scholarship, for the good and for the bad, you get an orientation and kind of a basic, a basic summary of what the political and the cultural situation is in Mexico. And then you are off, you get your stipend, and then you're off to find your apartment. And so it took me a little while in Mexico City, which parts of it are a bit questionable. Parts of a good bit of Mexico are a bit questionable, even though I love the country. But you were basically kind of on your own to find a place and make sure you feel safe there. And so it's very much, I mean, it's for the good and for the bad. I mean, you are having your own experiences with, you know, in this country, and you are seeing that, you know, the good and the bad of this country as, you know, a normal individual. You don't really have, I mean, as much as I had some really great colleagues in the Fulbright program, and we, you know, hung out sometimes, and it was a really great community of people working on different projects. But people are mostly independent there. You know, it's not like you can go to the base and go to the commissary, you know, and buy some Fritos. But actually in Mexico, there's a lot of Fritos. They're actually one of the highest consumers of junk food. So you actually could. But the point is that you can't just go somewhere on base like you would if you were stationed in Japan, and go get American goods. I mean, with the Fulbright program, you're not really going to touch base with the embassy that much. I mean, you're kind of under their protective umbrella, but not so much so. My parents now work for the State Department, and they are part of the embassy community. I mean, for the people that are doing Fulbrights, I mean, you're not as much part of the umbrella. You're kind of, you know, alone and unafraid in many ways, going out and experiencing this country on your own. I mean, negotiating your own rent, for example, signing your own contracts for rent, sometimes with very sketchy landlords. I mean, you're out there, for the good and the bad, having these, you know, very real experiences. And I think that, that experience was very formative for me, in coming back and really having the confidence to write my dissertation and kind of having a motivation to write my dissertation, and for having, you know, for having the kind of oomph to kind of get my ideas out there.
Awesome. If someone's listening and they're interested in pursuing a Fulbright scholarship as a veteran, What advice would you give to them on the application process or how to go about that? I know that you kind of you gave us a good overview already of what that application process was like, but just any advice if someone said, "Hey, I want to do this," what 2 cents would you give me as I think of applying?
Well, you can apply. I mean, the first step would be to figure out if you want to apply independently or you want to apply through your school. And a lot of schools, I mean, if you went to a university, many of them have a Fulbright office so that even if you're alumni, you can touch base with the school. And it really helps. It really amplifies your case if you apply through a university that you know, is connected to the program. I mean, so that would be the first step. And then also figuring out what you want to do as well. I mean, for me, I went to Mexico during my fourth year of grad school. And so I already had a research agenda developed. I knew what I wanted to research. There are other programs that are out there. I mean, so if you don't have something to research, perhaps you want to go as an English language or an English teaching assistant. And these are many of these were people that had just finished their undergrad, and they were assigned to in this case to a family most of the time, and then also to a school throughout Mexico. Some closer to Mexico City, some in other parts of Mexico, and you were teaching English to people in many cases that didn't know English at all. I mean, and this was a great stepping stone for people then who would come back. And, you know, I met a couple of English teaching assistants who then came back, applied and got into medical school really quickly, law school, some really great law schools. So it was a really great kind of buffer period and transition period into the next stage, even though they didn't have a very specific, something specific that they wanted to research like me. And other researchers there. And so the English teaching assistant program is actually the biggest portion of Fulbrights in a country. The researchers make up a smaller contingent. There are people that do there's a business program. And then there are also professors that are already down there that are down there also doing Fulbrights, whether it's teaching Fulbright or doing research for a book project.
And one thing that pops in my mind that I usually ask too is, I'm curious from your perspective, because you've had such a different journey than so many people I've spoken with. And I'm wondering, what were the more surprising aspects of your transition to civilian life? Like, what did you, when you were on active duty, thinking of life after active duty, what did you not know to expect?
I think that I've always in some way, shape, or form been connected to a military community. And I guess I didn't expect how different it would be not necessarily being connected to a military community. And now in many cases, I mean, there's vet groups, there are other options out there that kind of fill that void. But in many cases, I think I definitely took for granted in the military community, how people reached out to help each other, reached out to help new people coming in. And I certainly have made wonderful friends here in Nashville since starting grad school and have developed my own community. But it is definitely different than the communities that we're exposed to in the military, especially when you're arriving in a new place, when someone new is coming in town in your command and you're taking them out to eat on Friday night. You know what I mean? You're introducing them to other people. I mean, that's just sort of what you do as a sponsor. And even if you're not officially someone's sponsor, you want to kind of take on that role because that's sort of what we do as part of our units in the military. And it really kind of, you kind of jump in very quickly asking where someone is from and you're all automatically part of this larger network, this larger whole. And outside of that, I think, and perhaps it's different, if people are working in corporate America or other things, but it's just, I mean, that kind of network, I think that I'll never find anything like that again. And definitely not to, it's start a sob story here or anything like that. I have wonderful friends here, but I mean, I think that the military network is, that we have experienced is just, there's nothing like it, in terms of how it frames everyday social interactions, helping new people, helping other people who are transitioning to the next stage. It's just a really wonderful thing.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm just, I want to ask one more question, which is just turning it over to you to share anything we didn't cover. But I just really appreciate, and it's really inspiring hearing your story of going from a certain path in the military to just a lot of off-roading and in a foreign country. And like you said, negotiating rent and just learning all these new things and then forging ahead in the world of PhD of where you have to really carve out your own path. And I'm so excited to hear what lays in store for you because it's such an incredible background between the military and the Fulbright scholarship and now the PhD process. I just know you'll bring so much energy and life into everything you do. And so I just appreciate the role model you are for other veterans who want to pursue either what you're doing right now or just that role model for someone who's chosen a different path and pursued it with a lot of passion. So the last thing that I would ask is I just like to always make room at the end to say, is there anything else we didn't cover that you'd like to share with a veteran audience listening, personally or professionally, things that you'd want to pass on to them?
I think the only thing I would say, and I think I alluded to this earlier, was more along the lines of, if you don't have this perfect plan carved out for yourself, for this seamless transition getting out of the military, and if you can afford to do so, it's okay to have some breathing room from the military in order to make the best possible decision for yourself. And again, everyone's personal circumstances are different. And some people have less flexibility than others in that department. But kind of like sometimes just kind of stepping away and really kind of getting to know who you are and then also who you are away from the military and really what makes you tick and what your strengths are and what you really want for yourself as a person. And then also what you want for yourself professionally. Sometimes, when you kind of step back from this really wonderful network and thing that we are, our military experience, sometimes you get some really interesting clarity and you are able to kind of forge a new path for yourself. So I would encourage, people to, if they can and they want to do that and explore that, to do so. But if you are the kind of person that's very comfortable with getting into, right into another job, that's okay too. But I'm just saying for me, it is really worked out to the point where I kind of took a step back and that's definitely made all the difference.
Well, thank you so much, Eileen, for joining us and sharing all this, this great advice. And, I look forward to seeing you in the future as a talking head and in political spheres and knowing that, you started out in some ways on Beyond the Uniform. So thanks for making time for us.
Awesome. Thank you, Justin.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, three important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.